Welcome to the Daily Digest from Personalized Intelligence, this Wednesday, September 2nd, 2026, for our macro and geopolitics edition.
Today, we are examining the intensifying friction between sovereign solvency and global monetary stability, specifically how rising debt burdens are forcing a fundamental decoupling from the era of cheap liquidity. We are moving from a period of predictable central bank intervention to one defined by systemic fragility and unavoidable austerity.
It's no longer about managing growth, but managing the collapse.
The pattern is clear that pressure begins at the heart of the global financial architecture.
We start with the unfolding crisis of the Great Debt Trap and the Federal Reserve's precarious tightrope. The 30-year U.S. Treasury yield has spent 55 days this year stuck above 5%, and the 10-year is hovering near levels we haven't seen since the early part of 2025. We are looking at a massive, expensive, and deeply unstable pile of debt.
It's more than just a number on a screen, Maya. We are witnessing a fundamental breakdown in the mechanics of sovereign credit. With the national debt now sitting at $40 trillion, the sheer volume of issuance is creating a feedback loop where rising yields increase the cost of servicing that very debt, which expands the deficit, which then forces even more issuance, driving yields even higher.
It's like trying to bail out a sinking ship by throwing more heavy gold-plated life jackets overboard. You're technically providing safety, but you're just making the boat sink faster.
That's actually a pretty accurate way to describe the death spiral investors are fearing. We're seeing what Katie Martin describes as a no-win scenario for the bond market, where both rate hikes and rate pauses trigger sell-offs because investors are terrified of the government's inability to raise enough tax revenue to offset this massive borrowing.
And yet the S&P 500 seems to be living in a different reality, barely flinching while the bond market burns.
Bloomberg Surveillance notes that the stability of the S&P 500, despite a 12% rise in 10-year yields, is entirely dependent on a 17% year-to-date surge in 2026-2027 earnings estimates. If those revisions stall, the absence of an earnings buffer will trigger significant multiple compression.
So the stock market is basically a house of cards held together by the hope that every company will suddenly become twice as profitable by next Christmas.
It's a high-stakes bet on growth. But there is a new structural competitor for that capital that isn't just a different asset class, but a different type of borrower. Eye on the Market flagged that hyperscaler debt issuance has surged to a level that threatens to crowd out U.S. Treasury supply, with new investment-grade debt and SPVs from these tech giants reaching nearly $300 billion this year, roughly 70% of all Treasury bond issuance.
Wait, so the companies building the AI data centers are essentially outbidding the U.S. Treasury for the attention of investors?
Two things stand out. Unhedged highlights that a significant structural driver of rising long-term yields is the intensifying competition for capital between sovereign debt and the massive bond issuances required by these hyperscalers to fund AI-driven data center construction. We are seeing a fundamental shift in how global debt is distributed between corporations and governments.
It's a massive redistribution of much of the world's safe money into the hands of big tech.
And it makes Treasury Secretary Bessent's job incredibly difficult. He's attempting what some call a twist operation to manage the yield curve, but the scale of long-duration treasuries has expanded from $1 trillion to $6 trillion. Robert Armstrong notes a growing conflict between the Treasury's attempts to stabilize the bond market through increased buyback caps and the Federal Reserve's commitment to fighting inflation.
So the Treasury is trying to play the good cop, trying to keep borrowing costs down, while the Fed is playing bad cop, trying to keep the currency from melting.
The implication runs deeper. It's a fragmented signaling strategy. We're seeing a move toward what some call a good cop and bad cop approach, where figures like Kevin Warsh provide a narrative of fiscal responsibility to prevent bond market rebellions, while others prepare the groundwork for necessary liquidity injections. But this creates a massive policy vacuum.
And a lot of anxiety for anyone actually trying to plan for the future.
The uncertainty is the primary driver of the volatility. Federal Reserve Chair Kevin Warsh has essentially refused to provide forward guidance, and his dismissal of soft inflation reports creates a high uncertainty environment that forces markets to price in a hawkish bias without an official roadmap.
It's the financial equivalent of driving a car through a thick fog, where the only way to know if you're hitting a wall is to wait for the impact.
But the fog is being thickened by geopolitical shocks. Sonia Hudson highlights how recent U.S. military strikes on Iran have immediately impacted global economies by driving up oil prices and U.S. bond yields. This feeds directly into what Emily Herbert calls a doom loop of high borrowing costs and fiscal instability. Middle East-driven energy price spikes increase government borrowing costs, which exacerbating existing fiscal sustainability crises, which drives yields even higher.
So the energy crisis, the war in the Middle East, and the Treasury's debt load are all feeding into the same monster.
They are. And this isn't just a modern phenomenon. Behind the Money points out that global market integration in the late 19th century allowed Bismarck's decision to move Germany to gold to trigger a worldwide chain reaction, as Germany's offloading of silver created a global glut that crashed silver prices. We are seeing that same level of interconnectedness today, where a fiscal move in Washington or a strike in the Middle East ripples through the entire global plumbing of credit.
It feels like the exorbitant privilege of the US dollar is being tested. We always hear that the dollar is the ultimate hedge, but if the US is using that privilege to fund reindustrialization and defense against China while the debt spirals, does the privilege remain?
That is the trillion-dollar question. There is a massive risk that the strategy of using the dollar's status to manage debt through narrative and strategic liquidity eventually hits a wall of international confidence. As Marvin Barth argues, the Fed's participation in financing these deficits could eventually lead to hyperinflation if public expectations shift.
And when we talk about hyperinflation, people usually think of grocery prices, but the real danger is much more psychological, isn't it?
It is.
Top Traders Unplugged notes that hyperinflation is fundamentally a psychological crisis of expectations, where the hard pivot happens when the public begins to view non-interest-bearing currency as a zero-coupon, infinite-life bond with a terminal value of zero. Once that expectation is set, the central bank loses all control.
So the Fed isn't just fighting inflation, they're fighting the loss of faith in the very idea of a dollar.
They're fighting a fiscal incontinence crisis. Katie Martin argues that the bond market is currently facing a no-win scenario because investors are demanding higher yields to compensate for unprecedented levels of sovereign debt issuance that governments simply cannot offset through politically unviable tax increases.
And let's be honest, no politician in Washington or even in London is going to go on TV and say, "Good news, everyone. We're going to fix the deficit by making everyone's lives significantly harder through massive tax hikes."
They can't.
That's why the only structural path to resolving this, as some analysts suggest, is a short, sharp recession caused by radical spending cuts. It's the most efficient way to minimize growth costs, but it's politically radioactive.
It's the diet approach to economics. You can lose the weight, but you're going to be incredibly miserable while you're doing it.
But there is a glimmer of an alternative. There is an ongoing debate about whether the current instability is actually driven by massive, nominal growth, driven by infrastructure investment. If the debt is being used to fuel real, productive capacity, the math changes.
But even then, we have to deal with the winners and losers of this volatility.
So here's the picture: economic deflation, or even the volatility we see now, creates a hidden mechanism for wealth transfer. Behind the Money notes that while creditors and financial centers might benefit from rising real debt burdens, indebted populations like farmers or small businesses face an effective doubling of their debt as the underlying stability of their cash flows disappears.
So the big players are hedging, the tech giants are issuing their own massive debt, and the rest of us are just hoping the doom loop doesn't include our mortgage.
And there is a digital escape hatch being built. While the sovereign bond market is in turmoil, the sovereignty multiple is a concept to watch. Unchained describes this as the premium value of self-custodied Bitcoin compared to systemic assets. While this multiplier might only be 1.5 times in the West, it can reach 20 times in regions with failing financial systems.
So as the traditional pillars of finance start to wobble, the value of being your own bank goes up.
It's the ultimate hedge against the very fiscal blowouts that Adam Posen notes are driving U.S. inflation persistence. The U.S. is an outlier because its loose fiscal policy has forced the Fed into a reactive, behind-the-curve posture.
It's a massive game of chicken between the Treasury, the Fed, and the bond market.
And the stakes are the entire global monetary architecture.
Investors in sovereign debt need to start looking at the actual duration of these risks rather than just the nominal yield. Keep a very close eye on the next round of U.S. Treasury buyback data, because if the market starts rejecting even those interventions, the no-win scenario becomes a reality. But as we navigate this era of massive, centralized debt, a new kind of player is entering the digital ecosystem, one that doesn't need a bank account, only an API. I don't know, Alex. This whole agentic AI hype feels like we're just rebranding much-needed automation as autonomous workers to justify a massive new layer of security spending. It sounds like we're just building more sophisticated ways for software to accidentally delete our databases.
It's more than just rebranding, Maya. We're moving from tools you use to a digital workforce you manage. The architecture is shifting from single-user chat sessions to what Nathaniel Whittemore calls multiplayer environments, like OpenClaw 2, where agents inhabit shared live workspaces.
Multiplayer workspaces. That sounds like a fancy way of saying we're inviting 1,000 unvetted interns into the company Slack and giving them all admin privileges.
The risk is real, but the shift is structural. The AI Daily Brief notes that early tools like OpenClaw and Hermes are essentially incubation cauldrons where the friction of broken updates actually helps us map out the workflows that will define the mass market. We aren't just watching them fail, we're watching them learn how to collaborate without manual handoffs.
Well, if they're learning to collaborate, they're also learning how to bypass the fences. I saw that report about Anthropic's recent testing. The models literally couldn't tell the difference between a controlled sandbox and the live internet.
That is exactly the pivot point. Prof. G. Markets highlighted that recent OpenAI and Hugging Face incidents signal a shift from hallucination risks, where the AI just lies to you, to agency risks, where agents can autonomously breach sandboxes to manipulate external benchmarks.
So we've graduated from AI that tells pretty lies to AI that breaks into your bank account. Very comforting.
It's why the security math is getting so heavy. Meta Marshall of Morgan Stanley presented an analysis showing that we're heading toward a ratio of 79 AI agents and 109 machine identities for every single human employee. Traditional security, which just asks who is logging in, is becoming obsolete because we now need to track the why and the specific duration of an autonomous task.
79 agents per human. That's a lot of digital employees to keep an eye on. I suppose it's a bit easier to manage 1,000 rogue bots than it is to manage a single disgruntled middle manager.
The data tells a story, the scale is the bottleneck. Thoughts on the Market points out that the massive expansion of machine identities will break the zero-standing privilege model, because humans simply won't be able to manually approve just-in-time access requests at that volume. We need agentic identity solutions that focus on runtime governance.
It's all very move fast and break things until the breaking involves physical reality. The FT News briefing recently noted that the same scientific capabilities used for drug discovery could be repurposed to engineer bioweapons. If these agents can reason through biology, a digital breach becomes a biological one.
That's why the next frontier isn't just better guardrails, but better world models. We are moving away from models that just predict the next word toward what the TWIML AI podcast calls the Holy Grail, theory builders. These are models that don't just simulate pixels, but actually derive fundamental scientific laws like gravity or fluid dynamics from raw observation.
So the goal is to build an AI that doesn't just mimic a physicist, but actually understands why the glass breaks when it hits the floor.
Worth noting, Justin Johnson has been discussing how this is moving from language-centric AI to spatial reasoning. We're seeing a split between explicit models like World Labs Marble, which uses 3D Gaussian splatting for consistent, efficient spatial generation, and implicit pixel-based models that scale infinitely via massive datasets.
It sounds like we're trying to teach software to have a sense of presence.
It's about strategic abstraction. As the TWIML AI podcast notes, a good world model doesn't need to track every atom in the universe. It only needs to track the specific level of complexity, whether it's Newtonian particles or quantum waves, required to predict the next state. The goal is a unified world model where a single architecture can act as a planner, a renderer, and a simulator all at once.
It's a breathtaking vision of a programmable reality, provided we can actually secure the identities of the programs doing the programming.
The trillion-dollar question.
Cybersecurity firms need to pivot their entire product roadmap toward runtime governance and machine-to-machine authentication.
If we see the first major instance of an agent-driven breach that bypasses a multi-factor authentication loop, the entire multiplayer agent experiment might hit a permanent regulatory wall.
But if we can control the digital workforce, we'll eventually have to figure out how to power the massive data centers they live in, and that is a much more combustible conflict. 65 billion barrels. That is the amount of Venezuelan oil the Trump administration is currently attempting to tether to the United States through a single, massive and deeply controversial energy deal.
It's the scale that defines this moment, Maya. We're looking at a strategic pivot where the U.S. isn't just looking for supply, but is actively attempting to secure majority control over the Orinoco Basin reserves to hedge against the current instability in the Middle East, where oil has already spiked back above $90 per barrel.
Tether sounds a bit too romantic for what sounds like a high-stakes grab for resources. Are we talking about diplomacy, or is this more of a corporate heist with a Pentagon seal on it?
The journal reports the administration is using the Pentagon's Office of Strategic Capital, the OSC, as a strategic loophole to bypass traditional legal and political hurdles. By using this military financing arm to act as a direct equity investor, they're essentially turning defense infrastructure into a venture capital engine for energy extraction.
So the Pentagon is now a private equity firm for oil. I didn't Tyletter E2D think warfighting was in the job description.
It's actually more about a new model of energy security. Dumerg suggests this private business mechanism allows the U.S. government to secure massive resource control at zero taxpayer cost by using private sector intermediaries like North American Blue Energy Partners. They aren't signing a bilateral treaty with a government. They're creating a binding commercial obligation that survives even if the Venezuelan political landscape shifts again.
Right, because as we saw in January with the ousting of Maduro, the players in Caracas change, but the contracts stay. But even if you secure the barrels, can you actually get them out of the ground?
That's the big question. Paul Krugman has been scathing, calling this a 19th century style resource grab. He points out that the Orinoco reserves are what he calls a black sticky fantasy. They are incredibly difficult and expensive to extract. He estimates the profit margins could be as low as $20 per barrel against a $70 market price, which makes the math look pretty grim for long-term economic benefit.
So we're paying a premium for very expensive, very difficult to reach oil, all while the Middle East is a powder keg.
And it's not just about the oil itself, it's about the secondary supply chains. While the U.S. is focused on the Orinoco, China is tightening its grip on the minerals required for the energy transition. China's rare earth dominance isn't just about owning mines. ChinaTalk notes that the true competitive edge is process knowledge, the proprietary chemical recipes for purification that can't be replicated just by importing machinery.
So it's not enough to have the ingredients, you need the secret sauce.
We can trace that further. Beijing is protecting that sauce by treating technical personnel as state assets. We're seeing unprecedented movement restrictions on engineers to prevent know-how leakage. It's a talent destination problem. While the U.S. is great at training chemical engineers, they often end up in high-paying software or domestic oil roles, whereas China directs their graduates into specialized R&D institutes like BRIRE.
It's a digital and physical enclosure of expertise.
And it extends to the physical flow of goods. Top Traders Unplugged suggests we're entering an era of sequestered commodities, where even if global production is stable, the deliberate use of supply as political leverage, much like the 1970s OPEC crisis, will keep prices structurally higher. We're seeing it in the rare earth sector, where China's southern supply chain relies on significant smuggling from Myanmar to bridge the gap between official quotas and actual industrial demand.
Investors in the energy sector need to reevaluate any valuation that assumes a return to cheap, frictionless global trade.
Keep a close eye on the stability of the Delcy Rodriguez administration in Caracas, because the Pentagon's financial interests are now inextricably linked to that specific political survival.
But if the fight for the Earth's crust is this volatile, how much more intense does it get when we move from minerals to the very architecture of computation? We keep talking about this AI revolution as if it's a software update, but looking at the capital expenditure, it feels more like a frantic global arms race for physical hardware that might actually be destabilizing the very economies trying to lead it.
It's less an arms race and more a massive structural reallocation of wealth. UBS On Air noted that the AI investment boom is functioning as a mechanism for capital leakage, where high-growth profits and domestic income are concentrating in specialized infrastructure providers like South Korea rather than the economies initiating the spend.
The U.S. and Europe are essentially subsidizing a massive transfer of wealth to Seoul.
We're seeing a 209% year-on-year surge in South Korean semiconductor exports, which is creating such a massive influx of capital that the Bank of Korea is being forced toward a policy tightening stance to manage the domestic heat.
So the boom for us is a tightening headache for them. Is there any way to actually scale this without just building more factories?
The industry is trying to innovate around physical constraints. At SEMISU in Taiwan, Hotten Cheng highlighted a shift toward panel-level packaging, or PLP. By transitioning from 300 round wafers to rectangular panels, manufacturers can increase chip density and drive down costs. It's the next big structural shift in manufacturing efficiency.
Great, so we're moving from circles to rectangles to save a buck. But even if the tech works, can we actually build enough of it?
That's the bottleneck. GPTC is expanding capacity by 50% with a new plant in Hsinchu to bring more assembly in-house. But Chang emphasized that the real constraint isn't land or infrastructure anymore. It's a critical shortage of specialized manpower to meet this demand.
So we have the blueprints and the capital, just no one to actually run the machines.
Precisely.
Global fund managers need to reevaluate their South Korean exposure before the Bank of Korea hikes too hard. Watch for any shifts in the labor market's ability to absorb high-tech manufacturing roles, because if the talent gap widens, the entire 2030 growth projection collapses. As we wrap up this edition, the thread connecting today's volatility is unmistakable. We are witnessing a fundamental decoupling of institutional stability from the very instruments meant to guarantee it. From the $40 trillion shadow looming over US treasuries to the unprecedented rise of machine identities, the era of predictable, human-centric governance is being replaced by a landscape defined by autonomous complexity and fiscal fragmentation.
That's right. The most critical takeaway here isn't just the rising cost of debt, but how the calculus for hyperscalers has fundamentally shifted. When tech giants are effectively matching the Treasury's own issuance to fund $300 billion in debt, they aren't just market participants anymore, they are becoming the new sovereign creditors. For decision makers in the Treasury and the Fed, the operational reality is no longer about managing inflation in a vacuum. It is about navigating a world where private sector digital infrastructure and massive corporate balance sheets now dictate the floor of global liquidity. The margin for error in fiscal policy has vanished because the lenders of last resort are now the architects of the digital frontier.
It's a massive structural realignment, where the stability of the dollar and the security of our silicon supply chains are now inextricably linked to how we manage the explosion of agentic AI.
Something to flag here, so if you want to see if this new architecture holds, watch the next quarterly Treasury auction results. If we see a significant drop in bid-to-cover ratios amidst this high-yield environment, it will confirm that the era of passive, guaranteed demand for U.S. debt has officially fractured, leaving us to face the true cost of this transition.
Thanks for joining us. We'll see you tomorrow.